Good morning. I'm Diane Rowland, the Executive Director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and it's my pleasure to welcome you today to our 16th annual Kaiser 50-State Medicaid Budget Survey that documents the slowing growth and evolving policies. And we're conducting this forum in cooperation with our Medicaid directors, the National Association of Medicaid Directors, without whom this survey would not be possible, since it is the Medicaid directors that give us all the valuable information that we will be presenting today. When the Kaiser Commission was set up in 1991, we sought to shine a light on the role of Medicaid. It was a little notice program that mainly served a welfare population. Now, 25 years later, Medicaid has emerged into the spotlight, even mentioned in the last non-substantive presidential debate as one of the few items of substance at that debate. And our goal has always been to keep a focus on Medicaid, the important role it plays for the millions of low-income Americans who depend on it, and the 50 states and their staff who manage it and set many of its policies and priorities and help shape its future. So it's with great pleasure that we every year are able to provide a fact-based summary of what's going on in the states with the Medicaid program. This annual budget survey serves as an important contribution to understanding Medicaid's role and providing real-time facts about how the program works and the policies in place in the 50 states. It does document the diversity of Medicaid programs. We know if you've seen one, you've seen one. You haven't seen all 50. And the communities that support the program, the many initiatives that are underway. And I think it really does demonstrate to you that this is not an antiquated program. It's a constantly evolving program to continue to meet the challenging health needs of our lowest income and most vulnerable Americans. So I'm pleased to release the 16th annual survey that we undertook in partnership with Health Management Associates and with the cooperation of the 50 Medicaid directors who give us their time and information to make this 50-state survey a reality. So I thank the Medicaid directors all and the ones here representing the Medicaid directors today. As we move forward in this discussion, we're going to start by having a presentation of the key findings from the budget survey and from some of the spending and enrollment information that we've been able to glean from the survey. And I'm going to turn to Robin Rudowitz, the Associate Director of the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, and Vern Smith, the Senior Fellow with Health Management Associates, who helped honcho this survey. But I'd also like to thank Kaiser staff Libby Hinton, Larissa Antonese, and Allison Valentine, who made Robin's life a lot easier as she tried to go forward with this survey, and of course, Kathy Gifford, Eileen Ellis, and Barb Edwards, who I know Vern leaned on very heavily for his role in this survey as well. Following their presentation of the key facts and information from the survey, we want to give you some ability to get insights from the Medicaid directors themselves. And we've asked John McCarthy, the Vice President of the National Association of Medicaid Directors Board of Directors and the Ohio Medicaid Department Director, to moderate a panel discussion, and are really pleased to have two Medicaid directors with us, Lisa Allen, the Executive Medicaid Director of the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania Department of Public Welfare, and Calder Lynch, the Director of the Division of Medicaid and Long-Term Care for the State of Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services. So we'll give you some flavor of what's going on the ground in these states, as well as their perspectives on the overall direction of the Medicaid programs. Following this discussion, we're going to turn to you, of course, to open the format for questions and answers. Their bios of everyone on the panel are in your folders, as well as the slide set that will be presented by Robin and Vern, along with obviously the reports themselves. So without further ado, I'm going to ask Robin to kick off our discussion.
Good morning, everyone. Thanks, Diane, and for everyone who came to the briefing. I really want to echo Diane's thanks to my co-authors here at Kaiser, as well as HMA, and also to the Medicaid Medicaid directors. I wanted to start with a quick overview. As Diane mentioned, this is our 16th annual Medicaid survey. The survey is really two parts. We send out an electronic version of the survey, and then we do a telephone follow-up with all 51 directors. The survey is conducted in July and August, so most states are finishing one fiscal year and starting the next. So when we present findings for 2017, those are really projected and what states have included in their adopted budgets. We've used the survey to produce the three reports that we're releasing today. I will spend some time talking about the enrollment and spending trends, the skinny report in the briefing packet, and then I'll turn it over to Vern to talk about the much fatter report, which highlights the policy findings. So this slide really highlights two decades of trends in Medicaid enrollment and total spending. I want to make three key points about this graph. The first is that enrollment and total spending grow in tandem. Enrollment is typically the largest driver of Medicaid spending growth, and we see peaks when you see economic downturns or recessions. We've also seen another peak in enrollment and spending as states implemented the Affordable Care Act in 2014 and 2015. The second key point I want to make is to zoom in a bit on 2016 and 2017, the focus of this report. And what we're seeing here is a slowdown in both enrollment and spending. So we've seen a tapering off of ACA-related enrollment growth. I also just want to mention that in spite of these slowing trends, we are hearing from the states that there are some upward pressures on Medicaid spending growth related to some policy changes like reimbursement increases as well as rising prescription drug costs. And the third key point is that these trends are really operating within the broader economic context. Since the Great Recession, we've seen gradual improvements in the economy. What we're seeing in 2016 and 2017 is a slowing of state revenue growth. And when state revenue growth slows, that really puts additional pressure on states to control Medicaid spending growth. So we just looked at some of the national trends, and this slide really breaks down what was happening across expansion and non-expansion states. So to no one's surprise, in 2015, as states implemented the Medicaid expansion, we see a big differential in the growth rates in enrollment and total spending, with expansion states seeing much greater growth. In 2016 and 2017, similar to national trends, we're seeing a slowdown across both groups of states, and we're also seeing a narrowing in the differential in terms of the growth rates across those two groups of states. This slide really shows state spending growth and total spending growth. We know that financing for the Medicaid program is shared by the states and the federal government. These two lines also tend to grow at the same pace, except when there are changes in the statutory match rate for the program. So we see big differentials in these two lines in 2009 to 2012 as ARRA was in place, so the federal government was temporarily assuming a larger share of Medicaid financing. And we see a differential as well in 2014 due to the ACA. So under the law, the federal government was paying 100% of the costs of the Medicaid expansion in 2014 through 2016. So in January of 2017, states will begin to pay a small share of the cost of the Medicaid expansion, 5%. So we are seeing an uptick in Medicaid state spending growth projected for 2017. While not shown here in this graph, we are seeing a slightly higher uptick in expansion states compared to non-expansion states. But overall, across all states, the growth rates are pretty much the same in 2017. And this slide shows that to make up the state's share of Medicaid spending, most states rely on some type of provider tax or fee. 34 states have three or more provider taxes or fees in place. But we wanted to point out that 8 states specifically reported that they intend to use a provider tax or fee to help finance their share of those Medicaid expansion costs that will kick in January of 2017. So that sort of summarizes very quickly the spending and enrollment trends. And now I will turn it over to Vern.
Well, thank you, Robin, and thank you, Diane. And like Robin, I need to echo Diane's thank you for the team who worked on this. Is a big project, but you know, Kathy Gifford, who's here, and Eileen and Barb, co-authors on the budget, on the case studies, Sarah Jaeger and Pat Casanova. It's a big effort, and these folks did most of the hard work, so thank you very much. So let me just try to very quickly, let's see, here we go, go over the highlights of the report. I have an impossible job to do this in the very brief period of time that we have, so I'm going to start with some of the traditional measures for addressing cost control and policy changes in Medicaid. And we'll start with eligibility. Since 2014, the major eligibility change, of course, has been the Medicaid, or the ACA Medicaid expansion. That's where the attention has been, and properly so. Some would say this is the most significant eligibility change in the history of the program. Since 2014, changes in eligibility have been very few. Those that have occurred have mostly been positive, designed to streamline and simplify the process. For the third year in a row, no broad across-the-board eligibility cuts that have affected broad groups of beneficiaries. On payment rates, the story here is that we continue to see general increases, but it differs by provider category. So when you look at the second bar in from the left on nursing facilities, you see that about two-thirds of the states this year and last year increased rates for nursing homes. Among the 39 states that contract with MCOs, two-thirds of those states increased capitation payments for MCOs. Across all provider groups, setting aside nursing facilities where there was no change in the number of states from 16 to 17, you see kind of an interesting thing, and it's perhaps noteworthy to observe that in 2017, the likelihood of an increase was slightly less, and the likelihood of a restriction was slightly greater in 2017 compared to 2016. If in the report, there's a notation that across all provider categories, 41 states had some kind of a restriction, and one fewer state, 40, had some kind of an increase in provider payment rates. I do need to say that this is in part because of the way we count a restriction for hospitals and nursing facilities. For the full 16 years of this report, for these providers, which traditionally have been cost-based with automatic annual cost of living adjustments, if that annual cost of living adjustment didn't occur, in other words, if there was a freeze, that's been counted as a restriction. So when you look, for example, at hospitals, those 36 states that are noted with restrictions in 2017, five of those were actual cuts. And for the 19 states that restricted nursing facility rates, one of those was an actual cut. So looking at benefits, states making benefit restrictions is kind of a barometer of the strength of state budgets. So since the Great Recession, we've actually seen very few benefit restrictions. And we have seen kind of targeted, focused increases in benefits since that period of time. So in the 20 states this year, 21 states last year, the benefit increases that have occurred have really been focused on behavioral health services, on substance abuse services, telemedicine, and dental services for adults. Now, I have to say a few things about the pharmacy benefit. When we ask in the survey, what is the primary driver of your Medicaid spending growth? Robin had mentioned this earlier. For the second year in a row, the issue which really rises to the top across all states is the increasing pressure on spending from the higher cost of prescription drugs. So it's no surprise that two-thirds of the states reported very specific measures designed to slow the growth in prescription drug costs. A wide variety of measures were noted, utilization management, and so on, to address this issue. But increasingly, states are engaging their MCOs to assist them in this, since so much of, since MCOs are the primary delivery system for Medicaid across the country now. Medicaid also has a huge stake in the opioid epidemic crisis, and almost every state in the country now has a strategy designed to focus on opioids, oftentimes in conjunction with a broader public health effort. Long-term services and supports. So Medicaid is the largest single payer for long-term services and supports in the country. Historically, Medicaid has paid a lot more for institutional care than for services in the home and community. If you go back just two decades, in 1995, 82% of Medicaid spending for long-term services and supports was for institutional care, and only 18% in the home and community. That situation has completely changed as a result of efforts of states across the country and a rebalancing effort, if you will. And now then a majority of care, a majority of the dollars that Medicaid spends on long-term care actually in the home and community. This has happened through state efforts in waivers, state plan amendments, establishing and expanding PACE programs, and a variety of other measures. A very significant trend is the increasing role of managed care in long-term services and supports. And at the present time, in 2017, 23 states provide some or all of long-term care through a capitated risk-based managed care organization. In all but two of these states, these MCOs provide the full range, a comprehensive package of services that includes all primary care, acute care, and long-term services and supports. And in a majority of these states, enrollment of seniors and persons with disabilities and persons needing long-term care is mandatory. So turning now to managed care, again, we talk about the increasing reliance of Medicaid on MCOs as the primary delivery system for Medicaid services. There are 39 states, as I mentioned, now that contract with MCOs. Of these 39 states, in 28 of them, at least 75% of all Medicaid beneficiaries, not just families and children, but all, including the elderly and disabled, are enrolled in an MCO. And interestingly, last year at this time, that number was 21 states. So we've seen a significant growth in enrollment across all Medicaid populations. And you can see this especially in the bar on the far right in this graph, which looks specifically at the elderly and disabled. There are now just five states in which none of the elderly and disabled are in MCOs. And in 13 of these states, at least 75% are enrolled in MCOs. Now, when a state contracts with MCOs, every state is required to have a series of quality measures in place to monitor quality across a broad range of metrics. But states have a pattern of going above and beyond to pursue and to emphasize their policy priorities, perhaps child health, maternal health, or diabetes or asthma. So, when we look at what states are doing, 17 states last year and 17 again this year had new or expanded quality initiatives focused on managed care. So these may be pay for performance, oftentimes with a withhold that health plans have to earn back based on their performance. New requirements for public reporting of that performance. Those metrics are often used to help beneficiaries make choices of the highest quality plans or even in the auto-enrollment algorithm, and a number of other measures that states used in this regard to improve performance and achieve better outcomes through managed care. Managed care also is involved with a lot of the delivery system and payment system reforms that states have. In the report, you'll see that 42 states now have some kind of delivery system or payment system reform. These are major, complex initiatives involving patient-centered medical homes, ACOs, health homes, various payment arrangements such as episode of care, and several states are doing major comprehensive initiatives under the umbrella of the Delivery System Reform Incentive Payment Program, known as DSRIP. So last year, 21 states, 25 states this year are doing new or enhanced delivery system or payment system reforms. These initiatives and strategies are significant for how they coordinate and integrate care across physical health, behavioral health, and long-term care, and many of them explicitly include strategies to address the social determinants of health. So just to wrap up here, looking into the future, we asked in the survey about priorities for 2017 and beyond. And as we listened to Medicaid directors, these are the themes that we heard. I must say that the perennial issue of cost control really came to the fore as we listened to these priorities. So in the upper right box there, under goals, where it talks about cost containment, even as the economy is improving, the Medicaid spending continues to put pressure on state budgets, and the priority is there to take actions to control those costs. But the strategies now involve the delivery system initiatives, the coordination and integration of care, value purchasing strategies, various payment arrangements that are designed to lead to better health outcomes, as well as to slow the growth in spending. And especially for these populations that are listed in the center of this graphic, that involve persons with chronic conditions and high healthcare needs. We noted as we were doing the interviews, some Medicaid directors were very eloquent as they described their priorities and their urgency for addressing these issues. I'll just quote one, which is also in the report. Priority: maintaining budget control, integrating physical and behavioral health in a way that achieves the goals of cost, quality, and effectiveness. And on the administrative side, managing concurrent high-risk IT projects like eligibility system and an MMIS replacement. So these are big issues. It's never been more complex and difficult to manage a Medicaid program. And now I look forward to hearing the comments of these Medicaid directors who are here today to discuss their programs. So thank you.
So first, Diane, thank you for having us. And Vern, your staff are doing all the hard work on the report. I'm John McCarthy. I'm the Vice President of National Association of Medicaid Directors. I also want to say thank you to all of the Medicaid staff out there who worked on this report. I know Vern already thanked everyone, but I want to do it again. Many hours of our staff times go into this, just so you all know. It doesn't just, we don't get the survey and then fill it out in 5 minutes and send it in. There's a lot of detailed questions, a lot of detailed work that goes into it, so there's many hours that are spent on it. Then we all have great phone calls with Vern and the Kaiser people, where we have a lot of really good discussion to really get into the data, because I don't know how many of you have filled out surveys, but when you fill out a survey, there's a lot of nuances in there, and their team, I think, does a very good job of catching those nuances in the discussions with us to be able to report the data more accurately in their report so that it really lines up well. And so I just, a big thank you to them and all of the Medicaid staffs out there working on this report.
And John, if I can just interrupt, thank you for saying that. We really do appreciate it. Thank you.
As Vern said, it is an exciting time. I'm not one of the Medicaid directors who always comes in and says, oh, it's like the busiest time ever. I've been Medicaid director for a while, two different places, and it's an exciting time. There's a lot of great things going on. And so when you add this to the work that your staff's doing, sometimes your staff's like, really, we got to do that? And it's like, yes, because there's good things that come out of it. We learn as Medicaid directors, we were talking about it this morning over breakfast, of how we use the report to be able to look at a few different things in there. So with that, we are going to talk a little bit about what we do. And one of the things that's interesting to me is when you saw that last slide about the goals and priorities, It's funny because when it's those questions are asked for me, I say, well, which of the 10 number ones do you want to talk about? They're all number ones when you work for the leaders that we work for. But one of the things that I think people don't realize is what Medicaid directors actually do every day. I know sometimes you think that, you know, somebody like me who's come from a fiscal background, I just sitting there counting beans all the time and doing that. But I don't know how many of you follow Calder Lynch on Twitter. If you don't, you should follow him. He does amazing work, and if you, like I do, I follow him. He traveled around the state of Nebraska. And so, Calder, could you tell us a little bit about what you were doing the last few months?
Sure. Thank you, John. You know, I think it's a great question because there is often a misperception about what we're doing on a day-to-day basis. And it's easy to sit in the office and just look at dashboards and reports and studies and make policy decisions. But I think you lose a lot of, you know, visibility into what's really going on out on the front lines of where healthcare is being delivered and where our workers are interfacing with our members. And we're rolling out some, just like many states are doing, we're rolling out some major system transformations in the way that care is financed, managed and delivered in our state through a more integrated managed care delivery system with new populations, new services, and new health plans coming into our market. So we recently embarked upon a statewide tour. We did 8 provider meetings, 7 town halls, and I stopped and visited in 14 local offices across the state. And if you haven't had a chance to travel across the state of Nebraska, it's a beautiful state through the sand hills of the northern part of the state, and a lot of very, very small towns who, as I traveled across the state, had never seen anyone that worked as part of the state office building and the leadership there before. And so it was really important to get out and talk to folks, to hear directly from consumers, from family members, from our staff, from providers about what their challenges were, to understand what they were hearing and what they understood about the changes that were coming. When we took that information back, we really realized that we were missing some key elements in our messaging about some of the changes that were occurring. So it allowed us to course correct somewhat and publish new guidance, new FAQs, really supplement those documents, because as we roll out these changes, there's going to be noise, there's going to be things we didn't think about, there's going to be things that we missed. And so the more we go out and talk to people, the better we are prepared to deal with those and to have answers before we get to that point, so we make sure that, you know, care for folks is not interrupted. And really just to connect with people and to hear their stories and to hear what they're facing are the best things that we can do to really better inform the decisions that we make from a policy-making perspective, and to better inform what priorities we're really putting as number one when we're able to talk directly to the people that are impacted by those decisions.
One of the other topics that you heard Vern talk about was managed long-term services and supports and states moving in that direction. The state of Ohio, we entered into this area for the first time a few years ago with our duals demonstration project, which has been up and running for a little over 2 years now, which we've made big advances in there and have one of the highest opt-in rates in the United States for that program. And so we're gonna continue working through that. But Lisa, can you talk about a little bit of what's going on in Pennsylvania around managed long-term services and supports?
Absolutely. So in Pennsylvania, we've had a physical health and a behavioral health program for managed care for almost 20 years. Actually, February will be 20 years of our program. And so using that as a basis for looking at long-term services and supports, we know that that is a population that right now we do not have in managed care, and it's the greatest area of spending for us. So we are on the path to actually implement a managed long-term services and supports program beginning in a phase out in July of 2017. Like Calder, we did lots of public sessions with stakeholders across the Commonwealth. We've also been holding every third Thursday webinars with individuals to seek feedback, and those are very well attended. We've created some subcommittees of consumers and also did what we called some speed dating, where we brought providers and plans that were interested in participating with our managed long-term services and supports program together to really talk through what are the difficulties, what are the challenges that they see, what are the questions that they have, and also allowed consumers who were participants in our managed long-term services and supports program, namely the duals, individuals with physical disabilities, to talk to those providers, talk to those plans about what their concerns were in moving to a managed long-term services and supports program. For many, this seems very scary. And I think over the course of the last year or so, we've been able to gather input, as Calder said, and make some policy decisions, and in some instances make course corrections with some of those initial thoughts that we had about the program. So I think moving forward, this is the largest group that we currently have in still a fee-for-service environment for their home and community-based services primarily, and it will allow us to move those folks into a managed care environment. And really our hope is to have better coordination for those individuals, better integration of services, and hopefully help to navigate these very complex systems. The health insurance system is very complicated. These are very fragile individuals, and we see this as a real opportunity to bring those folks together under a managed long-term services and supports program.
One of the items under this I want you all to think about is, if you talk to individuals in Medicaid programs, especially in this area, you hear a lot about case management. And one of the things that we often find as Medicaid directors is there's a lot of case management going on. And it's how the system's designed. It's not a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's just how the system's designed. But you may have one, depending on what type of a system you're used, managed care organizations or PCCM, where you have a case manager there. Even if you're moving to patients that are in medical homes or an ACO model, you have a case manager there. But then all of our waivers, our 1915C waivers, home and community-based waivers, they require a case manager for long-term services and supports. Sometimes those two case managers don't talk to one another. Additionally, if you have behavioral health services covered in your state, there may be another case manager who's case managing those services, especially if you're in a carve-out model where that's still in fee-for-service and the other services are managed care. So there's a third case manager there. Then if a person goes into a hospital, there may be another case manager inside that hospital because they may be operating as an ACO. So part of what states have been doing is, how do you get those case managers to work together, coordinate, and have a working relationship, and who's responsible for which service? In the past, a number of years ago, there was a big push by CMS to have only one case manager, and that was it. They were only pay for one, and they would have to do all the services. I will tell you, from my view of the world, that just doesn't work, because the areas that you're dealing with are so specialized that you really can't get somebody that really understands the whole gamut of all the services that's needed. I know all three of us are also looking at the social determinants of health. So there's also another push for the case managers to make sure that individuals are connected with other things or identifying those other needs, and how do we get people hooked up with those supports too. So that's a lot of what I know the three states are doing, of how do you get those different services better coordinated to ultimately get you to better health outcomes. I know one of the things Vern showed up on the slide was a discussion about containing costs, but I will tell you, the number one thing Medicaid directors are really concerned about is health outcomes. It's how do we improve health outcomes, because it's our belief that if you can do that, that's how you really can see the costs controlled. One of the other items that Vern talked about was systems, very large systems. I was lucky enough that when I came to my new position in the state of Ohio, I walked in, and one of the first things on my desk was, hey, John, there's a new Medicaid management information system, a claims processing system that we have not been able to implement for the last 4 years. Hurry up and implement this. We were supposed to go live in 2 weeks. So, you know, I was like, welcome to Ohio. Luckily, I just left D.C. where I just implemented MMIS, and so I was like, okay, I can do this. And so we actually did. We got it launched and moved forward with that. Then right behind that comes the Affordable Care Act and the requirements for the new eligibility standards under the modified adjusted gross income. And guess what? Our 25-year-old eligibility system couldn't do those calculations. And so we reprocured a new eligibility system in a very short amount of time. We had it up and running in less than a year. And it worked. We were actually getting people enrolled, and it was working really well. So it can be done. We just, on August 1st, enrolled the age-blind and disabled population into that new system. So now in the state of Ohio, 100% of our Medicaid eligibility determinations are being done in our new system. We also then, you know, this is how the world goes. I walked in and had, at the beginning of the Kasich administration, implement a new MOS. Well, we're coming up on time to start re-procuring a new one. And right now, CMS has changed how they want states to procure systems. There's some positives to it. There's a few negatives to it. There's some making some Medicaid directors nervous. But I think there can be a lot of positives that are coming out of this. So one of the people that's actively involved in this right now is Calder. So can you talk a little bit about what you're going through?
Sure. As John alluded to, you want to see a Medicaid director wince, start asking him about MMIS procurements and replacements. These have been projects that have historically, despite John's successes for many states, over budget, not implemented on time, or not implemented at all. In fact, in Nebraska, we've had three previous failed attempts before I got there to replace our legacy system, which is a self-administered system, meaning it's run and managed by state employees rather than a fiscal intermediary. And it was certified as a claims processing system in 1978. So I often joke that we're probably the only state whose MMIS is older than its director. But it served us well for a long time, but it was clearly time to move toward a replacement. And really for us, trying to align those systems needs with our business needs and where we're moving forward within our delivery system. And as we looked into the future, as we continue to move more populations, more services into integrated managed care environments, we really didn't see the need for the state to own and run our own claims processing system. That wasn't something that was really needed to be a core competency for us, and the cost of owning and running that system would far exceed its benefits. So we opted instead to contract with one of our health plans to take on that scope of work as an administrative services organization to eventually take over the processing of the little bit of fee-for-service claims that will be left once we complete our transformation, and then instead focus our efforts on procuring a state-of-the-art data management and analytics solution to really be able to drive better decision-making about program changes, to be able to deliver better information to policymakers and legislators, and to be able to deliver better reports to the public about the performance of the system. So we're actually in active procurement on that system. We received 5 bids from various entities and are actively reviewing those bids. And then, as John said, CMS is really pushing states to pursue a more modular approach. So we've really tried to think creatively about that, including within the scope of our enrollment broker to manage health plan enrollment, having them take over the processing of capitation payments to our health plans, and then looking at our provider management system, in which we're about to look at a new procurement for that as well, to be able to screen and enroll providers and try to integrate all of those systems together is going to be a challenge. So we're working on trying to build our internal capacity to have the necessary staff and expertise to make sure all of those systems can talk to each other and still exchange data with some of our legacy systems until they can be sunsetted. But it's an enormous undertaking. It takes a lot of communication and partnership internally with your sister divisions, with your IT department. And we were lucky that we have a very good relationship internally to be able to work through those challenges. And it also takes working collaboratively with CMS because they are funding 90% of these projects. And so we have to make sure that we're getting those things approved. And while CMS has expressed this new vision for modularity and for being creative in some of these solutions, sometimes we're still trying to fit a square peg into a round hole in terms of some of how the regulations are written and getting those fundings approved. So it can be a challenge sometimes, but we're working collaboratively with them to do that. And it's an exciting time to be able to modernize systems to deliver better data. We're also in the midst, too, of replacing our eligibility system, which should go live next year. So certainly taking up a lot of our time and attention as well.
Lisa, I know you're in the same place as Calder, so can you talk a little bit about where Pennsylvania's at?
Sure. So our MMIS, we actually went through a transition back in 2004. And so we had some experience. Some of us are still there that went through that experience. And really looking into the future, what do we want this to look like going forward? With the delivery system changes that we are currently underway with, moving to manage long-term services and supports, we will really have a very small portion of our system that will be in the fee-for-service environment. And so, you know, looking at this not just for 2 years down the road, this is really a 6 to 7 year plan. And when you think about that in terms of where states are and what changes in a state, what changes come along in terms of CMS requirements at the federal level, trying to look ahead and plan and make sure that we're considering all of those potentials going forward makes it very difficult to try to make sure that what we're procuring is actually the system of the future. And so we're spending a lot of time planning for various stages of this new modularity and this new approach. And some of it is difficult to think through in terms of what do we want this to look like? What do we think CMS intended this to look like with their current requirements around modularity? So I think we have a path forward that we've talked about. We've had some course corrections along the way in terms of CMS's guidance to us as far as exactly what they meant by modularity, but I think we've worked through that with them. And we've issued our first RFQ on one piece of this, but we'll, like Calder, be issuing several more over a course of time to really look at the various systems, including predictive analytics. What does prior authorization really look like going forward? What does claims payment look like? We currently have a fiscal intermediary, but a lot of that is managed directly by us. We've built our own system that we now have to look at differently. So Calder's approach to contracting with a plan, looking at it as an ASO, those are all things that we are considering moving forward with in Pennsylvania.
And as Medicaid directors, we have a lot of geeky inside jokes, and one of them used to be, you know, bring up these MMIS systems is big, and whenever it fails, you know, you hear about it, right? There's a lot of stories in the newspapers. And there's failures all the time in the private sector, too. You just don't hear about it, except when it's the airline industry, right? So you're hearing about those, so we feel a little bit better. We feel their pain when those things happen. One of the other things that Vern brought up was the opiate epidemic. In the state of Ohio, if you read the book Dreamland, a lot of this started in the areas of Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, for a number of different reasons. And for us, in the Kasich administration, the governor, right after he was inaugurated, put us into a task force to address this issue. And it's across nearly every single agency that we meet and talk about the strategy we're going to take and the roles that we'll take. And Medicaid plays a role in that, often on the prevention and treatment side of taking on this issue. I know, Lisa, state of Pennsylvania, have been doing a lot. Can you talk a little bit about what you're doing in Pennsylvania in this area?
Sure. Similar to your task force, we have also been working collectively across agencies and directly with the governor on issues related to the opioid crisis in Pennsylvania. The CDC indicated that Pennsylvania was eighth in the nation as far as opioid deaths. Over the last year, we've seen quite a number of individuals die from opioid use, and we've really taken the approach of trying to bring Medicaid, the correction system, the mental health system, the drug and alcohol system together to look at this collectively. Some of the strategies and one of the key things that we're doing on the Medicaid side is creating kind of a health home-like environment for individuals. We've just awarded dollars to what we're calling opioid centers of excellence, and those are providers that will bring together community-based care managers and other folks who will be doing the prescribing for medication-assisted treatment services, really focusing them in the community to keep those individuals both initiated into treatment as well as engaged in treatment. What we're seeing over the course of time is that folks were initiating treatment, but by the 60th day, they had not stayed engaged in treatment. And so we're really trying to focus on maintaining those folks in treatment and keeping them there as long as possible. We are doing this both at the county level with county folks in our single county authorities, which are our drug and alcohol providers, but we're also looking to partner with our managed care plans to also have those centers of excellence be part of their networks going forward for January of 2017. The legislature did issue funding this year for us to move this initiative forward, and we're hoping that once we're implemented that we will start to see some improvement in the engagement of individuals, also working with the correction system. We are really looking at those individuals who are in both the state and the county prisons, trying to keep them engaged in treatment and connecting them with community resources, whether it be through our managed care plans or at the county level, to access the treatment on site in the community once they leave the facilities. So lots of different activities going on to try to get to the issues that we're seeing with individuals and the significant crisis that is occurring.
John, could I add a little? And we, you know, in Nebraska, we have not quite seen the growth in the numbers of opioid deaths that some other states have seen. So we are working to try to get ahead of the challenge by enacting some policy and coverage changes to tighten up prior authorization requirements for, you know, for example, two short-term acting opioids by two different prescribers. The second claim will deny. We put in a prescription dosing limit October 1st of 150 short-acting opioids doses per month. We had over 1,300 adults in our program that were currently at that level. And so we've been working with providers to taper, and our drug utilization review board to taper them down, and have not had a huge outcry with that effort. So it's been successful. And since January 2015, we have seen the number of individuals in Medicaid who are currently receiving an opioid prescription drop by about 10%. And in that same time, we've tripled the number of folks that were receiving medication-assisted treatment. So really trying to focus some efforts of getting ahead of that challenge before it gets to our state lines or in a higher level.
Keller, when you say it's not as large, can you talk a little bit about the scope, like relatively of large versus small?
True. So in general, we are a smaller state. I think in 2005, I think the state had one opioid death, and 2 years ago there were six. So an increase, but the scope of the numbers is just smaller.
One of the other topics in the survey was value-based purchasing. And this is an area where we have found in the state of Ohio, the state is a leader. There are some private entities doing this, but we're out in front with them, partnering with them in this direction. So Lisa, can you talk a little bit about value-based purchasing and what's going on in the state of Pennsylvania?
Sure, John. And I think Pennsylvania has been a leader in value-based purchasing as well. As I mentioned before, we have had managed care for about 20 years in Pennsylvania, and many of our plans have really looked at innovative approaches to working with the providers. I think I've probably spent lots of time over the past year and a half working with our providers to really encourage them to understand what it is we are looking to accomplish from a value-based purchasing arrangement. And it really is up to the plans to work with those providers, but I think knowing that we are also supportive of that approach. Providers have often talked about fee increases, and I meet with lots of providers every day where they talk about can we encourage a fee increase? Would this be something that we should consider? And I'm really trying to change that conversation to think about this in terms of what value and what outcome are you bringing for the participants that you're serving. And that's really what we want folks to think about. As part of our reprocurement of our Health Choices Physical Health Program, we have set targets specifically for our managed care plans. So in 2017, we've asked that 7.5% of their medical and maternity revenue be spent on value-based purchasing arrangements. In year two, that will move to 15%. And within that 15%, we're trying to move that continuum. So 50% of the 15% requirement will be at a higher level of value-based purchasing. So when we talk about value-based purchasing, it's generally pay-for-performance programs starting at the very lowest level and then moving along the continuum to patient-centered medical homes, ACO-type arrangements, and then finally looking at it more from a global perspective of global payments and full risk arrangements. So we'd really like plans to work with providers along that continuum to move to those higher level of value-based purchasing. In the third year, we have a 30% requirement that the plans will have to meet, and 50% of that 30% need to be in those higher level arrangements where they are ACO or full risk arrangements with those providers. And so when we're talking about that, it generally seems that we're thinking about it in terms of large health systems, but we're also talking about it for our DME providers, our home health providers, our pediatric shift nursing providers, who are all very interested in trying to make sure that individuals are being served, but we want to make sure that we're actually getting value, that they're keeping them out of the hospital, we're not seeing readmissions. That's the conversation we want providers and plans to be having that will lead to hopefully better outcomes.
And Keller, I know you're moving in this same direction. Can you talk a little bit about what's going on in Nebraska?
Absolutely. So we've also had managed care for about 20 years and certainly been an evolution over that time, both in terms of services and the geography that it covered and the progressiveness of the program in terms of payment design. And our new contracts, which begin on January 1st, we did include requirements that by year three of those contracts, 30% of their provider network needed to be in a value-based contract. By year five, 50%. And like Lisa in Pennsylvania, you're really trying to push the plans along that continuum, as well as looking beyond just the large health systems by requiring that it, you know, it be a percent of their provider contracts. It can't be accomplished with just one or two large health systems. They really got to reach out broadly into the provider community and engage with them at their level where they are in terms of moving them forward along that continuum, and really having the state continue to play that lead role, working with providers and pushing them in that direction. And actually, we've been very encouraged by the progress we're already seeing, even in the first year of these new contracts, with some health systems who are going into arrangements with some shared risk, with care management responsibilities, and some of our local ACOs that are contracting directly with the plan. So I think we're going to continue to push in that direction and measure what's working well and not working well, so that we can work with the plans to try to replicate the best practices in terms of those payment designs.
And in the state of Ohio, we're taking very similar approaches. The one thing that we're a little bit different on is we are a state innovation model grantee. And through that grant, we are actually working with the private sector. We have four of our largest private sector plans working with us in an alignment model for payment around episodes and also around patients that are in medical homes. The point of working with them is it's not just a Medicaid initiative, it's a payer initiative. So that when you go to a doctor's office, they're not going to change how they practice medicine if only 10 to 20% of the people in their office will be impacted by this change. But guess what? If you have 80% of the people in your office being impacted, you probably will change. So that's the direction we've really been pushing forward on, is how do we set up a system that both incentivizes the payers and the doctors in the system? Because generally what's happened in the past is it's been a one-sided equation often. Either the payers were making out or the providers were making out. And how do you go down the middle path? Now, in the model that we're using on both episodes and the patients in our medical homes, we do have a 50-50 shared savings model on the Medicaid side. So whatever shared savings there are, the insurers, which for us in the fee-for-service system, we keep 50%, but then the provider gets the other 50%, and that goes up over time. So with that, that was a very briefly of what three states are working on. Diane, I'll turn it over to you.
So you've heard what three states are doing, and the report that you have in front of you documents what all 50 states are doing. So I think you can see which states are engaging in which of these initiatives, and I hope you will mine the data in this report, because it took a lot of time to collect it, and I think it's a very useful overview of what's going on. And I hope hearing from the three states has helped give you some insight into what some of their key priorities are. I'm going to turn now to ask any of you in the audience to identify yourself, raise your hand, we'll get a mic to you, and if you have questions, you can put them forward.
Hi, my name is Mark Dan. I represent Compassion and Choices. We represent about 450,000 people who are looking at their options at the end of life and don't really like what they see. One thing we hear from a lot of our members is they're absolutely frightened of the Medicaid drawdown to go into long-term support services, institutions, and it's something they don't want. If you could say one thing to Medicare to prevent that from happening, what would it be? or if you want that to happen.
It's your chance to say something to Medicare.
Well, I'll thank you for the question, actually. I think it's a very good question. One of the challenges I think that we have moving towards managed long-term services and supports is obviously folks are very scared about what that means. And for us, I think on the home and community-based side, Medicaid has always been kind of at the forefront of making sure that folks can be served where they want to be served. And trying to make sure that that's in a home and community-based setting. And that's really one of the goals of managed long-term services and supports. And I think that's what we've tried to indicate to folks. I think it's difficult because on the Medicare side, it's very still of an institutional model. It really is not focused on home and community-based services. So I think working together with Medicare and Medicaid under a managed long-term services and supports program allows us that ability to bring folks services where they want to be served. I think from a Medicare perspective, certainly it would be nice if they would share in some of those funding of those services where we know people would like to be served. Medicaid does bear the burden of the cost of those services. Certainly there is a federal match to that, but I think if Medicare also moved in the direction of looking at providing funding for those services, we would see definitely more opportunities for folks.
And I think the questioner also thinks if Medicare provided more of those services, they wouldn't have to spend down to get on Medicaid. Okay, we have a question over here.
Hi, I'm Emily Jones from the HHS Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation. Thanks so much for collecting the data and this great presentation and the panelists. I was interested to hear a little more about the use of telehealth, and in particular, your view of telehealth as a potential way to get cost savings and barriers to the use.
So in Ohio, we've been using telehealth for psychiatric services for a while. We just implemented telemedicine for physician services a year and a half ago. We were pushed pretty hard to continue to add services to it, which I said I would. We're big supporters of telemedicine. It can be used. But at the same time, as a Medicaid director, we have to be careful of when you roll out a new service, how are you pricing it? Are you pricing it at a regular office visit? Are you doing 80%, 90%? And then what are the other rules that come in around that? And I'll just give you an example. As any rulemaking in federal government or state, there's a comment period and people come to meet and talk to you about it. And I had a group come in to talk to me about how we had a mileage limit. So originally we proposed it had to be 20 miles or greater in order to both sides to be paid. And I had a group come in to talk to us about how we could save a whole lot of money if we would allow telemedicine with no limit. And I was asking why, and it was because it was a hospital with a nursing home across the street. And it would save them a lot of money if the doctors, instead of having to walk across the bridge to the nursing home, could just do telemedicine across the street. And so there was a little bit of a, well, maybe that could work, but at the same time, would we just be paying for more services and not getting better outcomes? So those are the things, I know for myself, it's like, how do you look at those? You want to expand them. There's very, very rural parts of Ohio where we do have shortages, and so it's like, how do you open that up? And that's just for physician services, and then you start getting into some of the other areas too, outside of that, because you said telehealth, not just telemedicine. And so we're looking at all types of technology that we can go. I will say the one area that people often don't think of when they come to talk to us as Medicaid directors, I've had a number of vendors come in to show us technology, which is really, really cool, where you know you could just use an iPad to connect to a doctor right in your home. That's terrific. The issue is those services are usually based on how often you contact that doctor. And in the private sector, it works because you pay for the amount of access you can get, right? And so if you've got, you could, one was like per usage, another one was you would buy, 10, 20, 30 visits a month. But in the Medicaid world where our copayments are so low or none, There's no limitation there, but yet I'd be charged for all those services. So again, we're not against it, but how would you make it work? And the type of service delivery model we have is what we're trying to do. So in Ohio, we're continually trying to expand it. We're trying to figure out how to use technology more efficiently because we do think that will help improve health outcomes. Because with all the ways to gather the data, if we could get that into a person's medical record, we really would be able to serve people better.
You know, John, you've raised the rural versus urban issue, and all three of you have states that have substantial urban populations, but also a major rural constituency. Could you talk a little bit about the challenges a Medicaid director faces trying to cope between the needs in rural areas and what some of these payment models that really demand a larger network of people and providers means when you're trying to apply it in your rural areas? I'll start with Nebraska. I know that has a lot of rural areas.
In fact, our counties are divided between urban, rural, and many are frontier. Mm-hmm. And we actually have three different access standards based on those designations in our MCO contracts. And it is a big challenge for folks. You know, a lot of the folks in our frontier counties are really challenged with transportation and with access. And we're also working to expand telehealth capabilities, but like John said, in a structured way to make sure that we're managing the cost growth of the program. I think some of our biggest challenges are around transportation to getting to and from providers and finding transportation providers that are willing to go out into those areas. And finding providers that are actually that are there and willing to serve. I think we're going to have to get creative. We do have a rural ACO in our state that we're working with and the plans are working with. It is a very sparsely populated. Even for telehealth, broadband access is a challenge for many of those facilities and trying to understand what some of those unique needs are and having an adequate provider network. So I think, you know, partnering with like our public health department around how they're focusing some of their resources in terms of recruiting providers and doing some of those loan repayment programs. We were recently in discussions with them because there's provisions of those programs that do require that those recipients treat Medicaid patients, and we haven't really worked to enforce that so much. So working to see who those folks are and make sure they're meeting their obligations in serving the Medicaid population to improve access and working with our plans to develop strategies around telehealth and access improvement are an important part of our contracts with them.
I think, Diane, one of the things you brought up was payment strategies around the two. And what we found in Ohio, again, we have very rural areas, is that looking at payment at the rural level versus inner city is very similar. Yes, in an urban environment, you may have a number of providers in that area, but how many of them accept Medicaid? How many individuals are in the population or on Medicaid, and what would be the impact on that provider if they actually took, you know, a substantial number of Medicaid individuals or individuals enrolled in the Medicaid program on their bottom lines. So what in talking to providers, it's usually similar issues that callers brought up, but on the payment side, you know, looking at new value-based approaches, those providers are interested in those too. The issue is how complicated or not complicated do you make those payment models for the providers? And those have really been our discussions. We were also just recently, we met with CMMI and CMCS to talk about the various models that are being put in. And when you go to a small rural community and you talk to physicians there, they don't understand MACRA. They don't even know what that means. They don't understand MIPS. You know, so when you talk about those issues, they do not know what's going on in those areas, and nor you can't blame them, right? They are serving people every single day, providing great services. They're not tracking all those things, and these are often, you know, physicians' offices of one or two doctors, and that's it. So a part of it is, how do we do education and outreach to those providers? And then how do we set payments policy on the Medicaid side to ensure that they could get in to start working in some of those value-based approaches to be able to take advantage of those and help them make it through that transition to how they're practicing now to where they need to go? And then hopefully the what we provide them helps them also in the Medicare world.
Great. We have a question here.
Thanks very much. Excuse me. Thanks very much. This has been really great. My name is Caitlin Conley. I'm with the National Employment Law Project. In looking at long-term services and supports, home care workers, personal care aides, really, you know, as providing the daily, you know, highest percentage of hands-on care, have a great opportunity to help impact health outcomes. And I was wondering, any steps that you've taken to help attract and retain that workforce, which has astronomical turnover numbers, or controls that you've put in place with managed care contracts to help make sure that these workers are, not only able to stay in the position, but are also having labor laws and their rights abided by.
That's a great question, and we have some, I don't know if they're unique, they may be unusual challenges as it relates to that workforce in Nebraska, in that we don't really have any agencies. All of our workers are pretty much directly contracted or enrolled with the state as individual workers, over 3,000 of them, and are working in a system which is not connected to our claims payment system, and it's very manual. They're having to send in paper time sheets on a weekly basis and being hand processed by state staff. We were able to begin making overtime payments soon after the law went into effect, and paying of travel time, and then come into compliance with those laws, but still enormous challenges administratively for them in terms of the enrollment process. As individual providers, they're held to the same standards as a physician's office, which can be very challenging for many of them. So we're really looking to how do we modernize that system beyond just managed care. I mean, that's certainly something we're looking at as part of MLTSS, but we've recently launched and are under process with a broader long-term care redesign project, where we've got folks that have come in to evaluate our system comprehensively, including the how we manage that workforce and what those systems look like, and have gone out to meet directly with caregivers and members to hear from them in terms of what those challenges look like, so that as we redesign the system and develop these recommendations for how we move forward, we're taking their perspectives into account and try to design a system in which we're providing the proper oversight to make sure we're, you know, getting what we pay for, and the patients getting the care, and there's quality, but that from that provider's perspective, that they feel valued, that they feel like they're being supported, and that they can be paid timely and accurately, and there's not too much administrative burden on them. And we still have a ways to go on that front.
Hi, I'm Joan Alker of Georgetown University Center for Children and Families, and had two questions for the panel. One is, how are you approaching and thinking about implementing the new federal managed care regulation? We're doing a lot of thinking about that at Georgetown. And secondly, with respect to the opioid epidemic, I was just curious, because in the national discussions, it doesn't seem like there's, in my view, enough recognition of the critical role Medicaid has to play in addressing that. And I was curious at the state level how you feel about that.
So I'll start with the managed care regulations. Obviously, being a significant managed care state, and I think we all are up here, and we've spent a lot of time talking about what does the rule actually mean for our programs. Many of us have had mature managed care programs for many years, and so the rule in some instances has created some uncertainties about certain things that we've implemented in the program. And I think without specific guidance from CMS and interpretations on exactly what some of those provisions in the rules actually mean for us, it could be significant. So I think we're still waiting for some additional guidance from CMS to understand exactly what impact certain provisions will have. And I will say probably the rate setting provisions and the IMD regulation provision is most significant for Pennsylvania. And I think probably for my other colleagues here as well. In terms of the opioid crisis, I think we want to look for innovative approaches to address that in Medicaid, and I think Medicaid has been probably a leader in this. With Medicaid expansion, just over the last year or so, when we've moved into a full Medicaid expansion in Pennsylvania, we saw 23,000 of those newly eligible individuals who actually accessed substance use disorder services. So we are seeing a significant impact in the Medicaid program, and I think we will continue to see that. And we have to look for innovative ways to make sure that those folks are actually getting the treatment that they need and staying engaged in that treatment.
On the managed care reg, I just want you all to understand that as these new regulations come out, we as Medicaid directors don't oppose every single regulation. I know it seems like it, but there's a lot of work that goes into it. And what you may see as like, oh, what's the big deal there? It actually can be many hours of work that have to be done, that there's a question of what's the benefit you get from that. And that means something else isn't getting done. I'll just give you one example in that reg, and that is the report card, the managed care report card. So it says every state has to have one. So we have one in Ohio, but we have no idea if that meets their requirements, it doesn't meet their requirements. Now, if they just come and say it meets it, okay, great, I can move on. On the other hand, if they say it doesn't meet it, it's going to be hours and hours of staff time changing whatever it is, how do we make it become compliant. And that's just one small piece in there. And there's many, many of those small pieces in there, and they all add up. And what happens is it just distracts you from the other things we're doing around value-based purchasing and ensuring better health outcomes for individuals. So I think that's one of those issues we're going to be, as states, working through over the next few years. And then the opioid piece, much like Pennsylvania, since Ohio is an expansion state, we have about two-thirds of the individuals in our expansion population that have accessed behavioral health services. And so that's a large percentage of individuals. Not all of it's substance use, but behavioral health. And you always run into issues. We're actually in the middle of a behavioral health redesign of our reimbursement system. Because in our old reimbursement system, it was just easier to say the primary diagnosis was mental health because you got paid more for those claims. And so we don't know how many people were duly diagnosed. And so we're going through some of those changes. But Medicaid in the state of Ohio has played a huge role in this, because before expansion, all those services were provided through counties, and that was done through local levies or some amount of money that went from the state to those counties. And over the years, under the last administration, those funds were actually cut over the 4 years because of the recession. And so one of the first things we did in the Kasich administration was actually elevated that, where the state took on the state share for those services, and then through expansion started providing a number of services. And so we're playing a very large role in the opioid epidemic and helping individuals on the treatment side, working closely with their sister agencies. And then additionally, it's the same thing on prescribing guidelines. We work very closely. Actually, my medical director works with the Department of Health's medical director in developing those prescribing guidelines. And we worked with the medical board and with all the agencies to come out as one entity, the state, to say, here's the direction we're moving.
Okay. We have a question over here.
I'm Jim Teisel from Berkeley Research Group. I first wanted to say thanks to everyone for continuing to produce this survey every year. It's a tremendous resource. My question is, with the majority of enrollees now being enrolled in managed care programs, what do you think are the implications for fee-for-service rate changes for providers when most of the people they're seeing are now enrolled in managed care?
So first off, for me, this was two questions in a row from people that I used to work with very closely or coach softball with when I lived here. So it's great to see you all.
And they're glad you're here.
Yeah, it's good to be back. Jim, it's an interesting question because it depends on your state, okay? And so I'll talk a little bit about Ohio, and then I won't talk for Tennessee, but how they do it differently. So what I found is in the state of Ohio, our managed care plans in general contract at a percentage of fee-for-service. And because of that, we actually have a lot of control still over the Medicaid budget by changing those rates, because when we change those rates, it flows through the managed care contracts, and so there's automatic rate changes there. Now, they can pay over the fee-for-service rate, which most of the contracts are, it's a percentage over, and that's how we get access through managed care. So you see it on that side. So there, for us, we still do a lot of work around fee-for-service rates and putting different quality components in there because of that flow through. Now, as time goes by, and now you look at, I know Tennessee, they change that completely, right? They say that their rates cannot be tied to anything. You have to negotiate all rates. And so in the past, what has happened, the reason for this is, in the past, what has happened is if you say you can't tie your rates to the fee-for-service rates, then what happens is they're all smart people. They just tie them to the Medicare rates. And so whatever the Medicare rates. And so there's really no negotiation that happens. So Tennessee had stepped in and said, no, you can't tie it to anything. You actually have to negotiate them. And so there's a little bit of a different model. But at least in the state of Ohio, they're fairly tied. They're tied closely together. So we do monitor those and look at those. And for us, it's a valuable lever that we still have, especially around the value-based contracting, because everything I talked about before, we're doing it all on the fee-for-service side to ensure those things are happening, and how do we pay for value in there. And actually, even going back to the question earlier about home and community-based services, we're working in areas there, too, to have value-based contracting, and our plans are doing things in that area because we do see that really good home and community-based services can reduce readmissions back to hospitals. So how do you hook those things together?
Robin. And just to elaborate a little bit on what John said, across the states, and we do have a little bit of notation of this in the report, that as we've moved to managed care, it is hard to decipher what some of those rate changes mean. So to echo that point, you really do need to know. In some states, it is a direct relationship, and in other states, it's not. You know, I still think rate changes are a reflection of what's happening in the economy broadly. But it is important to understand more specifically how the states set their rates.
I had a second person here, and then we'll go over to the other side.
Elizabeth Cullen with the Jewish Federations in North America. I echo everybody in saying thank you. This is an amazing presentation. I'm curious what your thoughts are about the expiration of the money that follows the person demonstration and how that'll impact your shift into home and community-based services. And then I'm curious whether you've been in touch with your senators and representatives.
So, you know, we're continuing in Nebraska to transition individuals and have actually dedicated some of the funds that we've had remaining since we were allowed to continue to expend those even beyond the expiration to the long-term care redesign project that I mentioned earlier. That's what we've used to bring in some of the expertise that we're taking to do the comprehensive evaluation of our system and recognizing that, you know, that program may be, you know, going away. And so we need to develop strategies in terms of how we continue to move toward community integration and helping individuals live in more independently for as long as possible. I have not directly had any conversations, but it's something we're watching very closely. I know NAMD is as well, and trying to determine what the future there looks like. But I think regardless, state Medicaid programs have been really the catalyst for much of the progress in terms of rebalancing that system, and will continue to do so through initiatives like MLTSS, where we're able to create other financial strategies to help push toward community integration.
And for us, I mean, I have to address this one because the state of Ohio, we're like number two right now. We have 8,000 people we've moved out of institutions into the community under our Money Follows the Person program, wildly successful. When I came in, we were under 1,000 people moved out, so we've moved 7,000 people. And so actually, we're in the middle of building our budget right now for the next biennium. And so we're looking at how would we cover those costs. We still see huge savings under there. And just to give you a little bit of an example, in our last budget, or the budget we're currently in, we created a graph. And if you looked at the state of Ohio and the number of people age 65 and older in the program in 2011, and then you looked at the number of nursing home bed days at the same time in 2011. So what I had my staff do is say, okay, take those, the number of people 65 and older, and just trend it out. Like, what does it look like over the last few, the actual numbers, not forecast, but the actual numbers. And so you can, as you can all imagine, in Ohio, we are an aging state. And so that number goes up like this. But if you look at nursing home bed days over that same time period, it's been going the opposite way, right? You would have thought they just would have trended at least together. They actually went down. We've seen over $1 billion in savings because of that difference. And so we're big believers in money follows a person. The question, your second part of the question, have we started talking to our state delegations? We just started in those conversations. There's so many of conversations we have. I mean, before that, we're having the conversations on the big increases in Part D clawbacks. I mean, that's a killer for us. And then also in Part B that we may be seeing here coming up. So yes, it's added to that list, and I personally would like to see that program go on. But if it doesn't, you know, I think states, we're very innovative on how we come up with new ideas, and we can figure it out.
Hi, my name is Rich Romansky, and I'm with Fair Health, and we're a nonprofit and provide clarity to healthcare information and insurance information. My question is on value-based purchasing. We've heard a lot of focus in that area, and I'm certainly interested in the episodes of care technique and model that you're looking at in Ohio and potentially Pennsylvania. It looks like it has a lot of potential for evaluating performance, and then that performance, if you can guide beneficiaries to the higher performing providers, that could really affect outcomes, and that's what we all want, is better outcomes. And has your experience been that, using episodes, and are you looking at that in Pennsylvania? Thank you very much.
So what you talk about is exactly the path we're going down, and so we just started, this year will be the first year where we're actually paying on the episodes. The information is extremely powerful. But you have to figure out how to roll it out so people can start using it. And that's our next step on this, because a part of is we have to start sharing that information. So for those of you who don't know, our episode models are based on a retrospective episode where an episode starts with a trigger event, and then you look over a period of time. During that period of time, providers just continue to bill as they always have. It's after the fact that what we do is we look back over that episode and look at the average for that provider for all those episodes. We line those all up, and we a year in advance, we say, here's our two thresholds that we're setting. And if providers come in above that threshold, there's a payback. And if you come in under the threshold and you have high quality, there's the 50-50 shared savings. And what you're just starting to see then is that report that a provider gets of where they're at. For the first time, they get to see where their cost for the episode, not just their cost, but overall, is high. Is it because the individuals that are going to see a doctor, that doctor is actually a part of a system, and so there's the facility fee tied to it, so there's more, you know, it starts giving them those types of information. And so a part of it is first getting physicians to see those reports and look at those reports, so they start making those decisions. Our next step after that, which is we're looking at it for a year from now or a little bit further, is how do we start getting that information to the public so people start seeing those also and tying those two things together. And we're doing the same thing as how do we tie that information in with our patient-centered medical home so a primary care physician gets that same information of where is the higher cost providers and where is the lower cost providers. But I agree with you, how do you get that information in the hands of individuals? But I will say one thing that we've noticed, and study after study shows, if you just give people the cost information, people will tend to go to the higher cost providers because they equate higher costs with better quality. So the big issue is how do you make sure you have a report that ties value, you're right? You know, it's not just, you can't just say, hey, here's cost and here's quality. Because again, if that quality is a five-star quality and a high cost, people tend to say, hey, well, I'm getting something for that. So it's how do you get that information into a person's hands to be able to make those choices?
Okay, next. And just to piggyback, you asked a question about Pennsylvania specifically, and yes, we are moving in that direction. We're looking at specific areas where we would want to develop episode payments and thinking right now about maternity and possibly asthma as a focus area to start. But I think we were working on our patient-centered medical homes and making sure that those are up and running in accordance with some advisory group activities that we've had over the past year.
Hi, I'm Rebecca Case from America's Health Insurance Plans, and I want to echo everyone's comments. Thank you very much to Kaiser and HMA for the valuable information, this report, and that you provide on a daily basis to all of us. But my question is specifically for Director McCarthy. To what do you attribute your success in achieving a high opt-in rate in your duals demo?
So when we were bringing up the demo, there was a lot of decisions we had to make. These are all difficult decisions for Medicaid directors, how you design a program. And there was a question earlier about it was the end of life care and Medicare, dealing with Medicare. Mm-hmm. I say this to this day, the duals project was the hardest thing I've worked on in Medicaid, and I've worked in Medicaid for 20 years. There's been no project harder than that. It's been fruitful, but it's extremely hard to get those two systems to work together. Many of you know in this room, before those demonstration projects, nobody in my department knew anything about Medicare. We never spoke to them. They never spoke to us. And even at CMS, there's not a lot of conversations between the two of them. Anyway, the point of that is, in making those decisions, one of them was, how do you work with the people who are currently providing services in the state? Do you require your managed care entities to contract them or not contract with them? One of our big decisions in the state of Ohio was how we worked with the AAAs, the Area Agencies on Aging. In the state of Ohio, they actually are the administrators of our 1915C waiver for individuals who are elderly. So they had a very tight role. They do the case management. They do the provider enrollment, and they negotiated rates. So part of this was, do you include them in the model or don't include them in the model? In the end, we said that we required the managed care plans to contract with them. And I still to this day say it's one of the better decisions I've made as a Medicaid director, because it really, the AAAs learned some issues, but the managed care entities also learned some issues. And that really was able to have those entities work together so as to bring down some of the fear levels that come up when people are learning about what's going on in those areas. We also worked with other entities. We had a number of meetings around the state to talk about the program and what we were trying to get out of it. And we continuously have meetings with people. We work with UCAN Ohio. We meet with them on a monthly basis to hear their input on what people are seeing and how do we get better information to individuals. The plans all have information they put out. We get their success stories. We've made videos from those success stories, put it on our website, and it's trying to say, here's the advantages you can have of doing it. One of the other things is to think about this, too, is that a number of the individuals that we're talking about are already in our program. They're already enrolled in managed care. And so before, it was just once you turned a certain age, you were just disenrolled. And so they're just staying with their plan. So that's a big part of it. And the other thing is, many of you, as you watch these statistics like we do, the penetration of Medicare Advantage plans. And so in the state of Ohio, one of the reasons we went this direction was we saw the penetration around Medicare Advantage continuously increasing. And part of that is back to, for individuals like myself and many in the state of Ohio, you received your insurance always through one of these insurers. And so when you turn 65 and were eligible for Medicare, because I was asking people about this when we were out and about, why did you choose? And it's like, well, I've been with this company for the last 10 years. Why would I not be with them? My doctors take it. And so there was some of that happened also. So those are the things that we really focused on, I think, has added to that.
Okay, one last question.
Hi, Rachel Jenkins from Avocent, a research and consulting firm here in D.C. You talked about the importance and volume of case management services, but also some of the challenges with coordinating care. Can you talk about how trends you see in the case management segment specifically and with the transition to managed care organizations? And are there any shifts in the way that case management is provided, either increasing use of contracted case management or investment in increasing state capacity for case management? And how are you adapting to some of those challenges?
So in Pennsylvania, one of the areas of focus that we've had probably for the last several years is really having case management delivered at the community level rather than at a plan with phone conversations between case managers and the individuals. So really having that out in the community, using community care workers, looking at other ways of engaging community personnel in the care management approaches. And many of our plans have adopted that approach as well. Certainly, there is still a lot of the telephonic case management that goes on with individuals. We are not doing case management at the state level, other than for those individuals who are in the fee-for-service program. We do have some specific case managers who reach out to high-risk individuals. But for the most part, we're trying to really encourage community-based care management, getting to people where they are, helping them stay engaged in treatment, and finding out what the barriers are to assist them.
Well, we've covered a lot of ground today. I think we could keep going for quite a while. I think it's kind of remarkable that we spent an entire 2 hours talking about the Medicaid program without going in and out of the Medicaid expansion debate. And it really reminds us that Medicaid is about a lot more than the Affordable Care Act. It's been around a lot longer. It's on the ground doing a lot more things. And I think perhaps of all of the briefings we've done in the 16 years, this one has had much more focus on long-term care and services and supports than any of the others. So I think it really shows you kind of where Medicaid is going on the ground. And I'm glad that we're not just talking about the eligibility under the Affordable Care Act, but instead really talking about the broad scope that this program plays in every state. And I hope you'll use the resources in the materials that have been provided to really understand in individual states, in your state or across the country, what some of the very challenging and innovative solutions that states are pursuing are, and what some of the areas of diversity. So I want to thank both the report people from both Kaiser and from HMA once again for taking on the task of pulling this together, but especially thank the Medicaid directors for participating. When I listen to John say how much work every report is, I think, well, this report also entails a lot of work, but I think it's a very valuable resource. And I thank our three Medicaid directors for being with us today and NAMED for working with us on getting this briefing together. So thank you all very much for being here.